Hi, I'm Johanna Ferreira, Content Director of Pop Sugar Juntos. Juntos is all about celebrating Latinx culture, pride, our many intersectional identities, and joy. Thanks to support from Prime, there's so much to get into over at Juntos this month. From conversations with the Latinx minds behind our favorite new movies and resurrected TV shows, to thoughtful celebrity commentary and exclusive interviews with some of the biggest Latin music artists today. And it doesn't stop there. Get more of the music, movies, and shopping you love on Prime. Whatever you're into, it's on Prime. Visit amazon.com/prime to get more of whatever you're into from streaming to shopping. And get all of our latest coverage at popsugar.com/juntos. Con amor, Johanna.
This episode is brought to you by State Farm. If you're a small business owner, you know that it isn't just your business, it's your life. And whatever your business might be, you want someone who understands. That's why you might want to check out State Farm Small Business Insurance. Why? Because State Farm agents are small business owners too, living and working in your community. That means they know what it takes to help you personalize your policies for your small business needs. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Talk to your local agent today.
Hello, and welcome to the Ezra Klein Show on the Vox Media Podcast Network. This episode is a fun one. I have Senator Al Franken on the show. Senator Al Franken, which is still a sort of funny thing to say if you grew up watching him as I did on Saturday Night Live. He's a senator from Minnesota and is the author of a new book, Giant of the Senate, which, unlike virtually all books ever written by politicians, is actually fun to read. I actually recommend it. But it's a really fascinating book in a way that I wasn't expecting when I opened up. In addition to the jokes, and the jokes are at least some of them are good. It is a story of Franken learning to be a politician. And what's unique about it as a story is that almost all political books are about how the politician at the center of them is authentic and unique and didn't need politics and isn't being made into a politician and is resisting Washington. And this book is really the opposite narrative. This is a book about Franken learning that he can't litigate his old comedy. Learning that he has to listen to his staff, he's going to listen to his communications director, learning that there's a reason politicians do what they do in interviews. It's a book about Franken's journey to appreciating at least some of the skills and the structures and the norms of American politics and the politicians who are running around within it. And for that reason, it's very interesting. And it's particularly interesting as a contrast with our current president, who also, to some degree or another, comes out of show business, but has taken the opposite tack. He does not believe he needs to learn from anyone. He is not looking around and picking up skills. He has not come to have a greater appreciation for the profession that he has chosen to shift to late in his life. So this is an interesting interview, not just because Franken is an interesting guy, but it's an interview about what it means to be a politician. What are the skills that help you as a politician? One quick plug, a big plug this week. I'm very, very excited about this one. We are launching Worldly, which is, if you listen to The Weeds, my other podcast with Matt Iglesias and Sarah Cliff, where we go deep in policy, Worldly is a lot like The Weeds, but for foreign policy. It's hosted by Yochi Driesen, our foreign editor at Vox.com, by Zach Beecham, our senior reporter, by Jennifer Williams, our deputy foreign editor. Every one of those people is an incredible genius, and I learn a tremendous amount from them every single day. And now you're going to get the opportunity to do it too. So again, the podcast is called Worldly. It is launching on Thursday, June 22nd. I've been listening to the early pilots. They are great. This is going to be great. And you should all go and sign up. All right. All that said, here is Senator Al Franken. So I liked the book a lot. And what I liked about it was that a lot of political memoirs are about the politician bragging about how they trust their instincts and how they're authentic.
Oh, that's
and
right.
How
yeah,
what
sure.
you see is what you get. And your political memoir is about learning not to trust your instincts and not to be authentic and not to show people the first thing you think. Were you thinking about that while you wrote that? Was that a decided break from the tradition?
Well, I was trying to be honest, and I knew that it was ironic that I know the people. I think I write about people saying, whatever you do, my friends going like, whatever you do, don't get a political consultant. Don't get one of those political consultants. you know, they're all whores. And they'll turn you in, they'll just give you the same thing everybody else is saying during that cycle, and et cetera, et cetera. And a friend of mine who didn't believe that was Mandy Grunwald, who's a political consultant. And I just felt like I had never run for office before, and I didn't. There was stuff I knew I didn't know, and I've known Mandy for years, and I trusted her, and I fall into that category of people who run for higher office for the first time, and either you're so full of yourself that you think, I know what I'm doing, the reason I've gotten to the top of my empire here is that I'm smarter than everybody else and I don't need any help. And those people usually lose.
But not always.
The only exception is if you get a lot of help from the Russians.
So one of the things I thought was interesting about that, though, is that in America, politicianing is often not thought of as a job. That we're constantly hearing people say that what we really need is not experienced politicians, but people can run the government like a business, or people can bring
well it's not a business
yeah. but it is interesting, this idea that there is a craft here that people need to learn, and that you were willing to learn it and also to portray that as a valuable thing.
I think you want people who are competent politicians in the sense that they don't screw up all the time and offend people right and left for no reason whatsoever that they could have avoided. I mean, I think we're seeing a lot of that right now in the president, that he is making mistake after mistake after mistake. Now he won the White House. He won the White House. So he had some really good instincts. One of his good, in the South Carolina debate, he basically said that W had lied us in the war. And that was just so outside the realm of what Republicans could say in debates, right? In presidential debates. And Jeb was there, and it's in South Carolina, very, you know, a state with a lot of military people. But everybody knew it. If a Democrat said it, it wasn't news or anything. But Republicans, that was outside what was permissible to say. And he said it. And as soon as he said it, everybody just went, yeah, of course. Yeah, I'm a Republican and I know that. And I don't think the other guys on the platform understood that.
So this is something that I find interesting about President Trump, which is that he's often called a liar, and he does lie.
All the time.
But he's also strangely honest at other times, like saying, for instance, oh, I definitely fired James Comey because of the Russia scandal. Don't believe anything that my White House said to soften the political danger of that. I'm curious of your assessment of him as somebody who has written whole books about lying liars who lie. He seems to me indifferent to the truth, but not traditionally like a liar.
I don't think he lies for the sake of lying. I think he said that because... Yeah, I think it was a point of pride that, no, I fired him. I fired him. You know, Rosenstein didn't. Sessions said it was me, and I was going to fire him anyway, and it was because of Russia. I think it was a really stupid thing to say. I think that Mueller probably used those words to as part of his justification to have obstruction of justice. investigation. I mean, let's see, you fire the guy who's doing the investigation on Russia and on Russia's interference in the election, and whether you collaborated or cooperated with that. That sounds like obstruction to me. I mean, doesn't it? Kind of.
there's a weird dimension I find to this whole investigation, where there seems to be a tremendous amount of effort going into finding out if Donald Trump has said privately the same things he has said publicly. So publicly, Donald Trump said, Russia, please hack Hillary Clinton's emails. I would love it if you hacked Hillary Clinton's emails. But there's a lot of effort going into seeing if they possibly said that privately, too, as if Russia couldn't, say, watch
television.
In
the context that he said that, it could have been a joke.
I agree that it could have been a joke.
Don't you think?
I think it was a joke a little bit.
I hate to cut him slack ever, But I kind of thought at the time that certainly you could say that was a joke. And I mean, there's many times he said things are jokes that they weren't jokes, right? That isn't one of them.
I think that's right. But then, and similarly with Comey.
That one's plausible that it was a joke.
Right? But on the non-joke side, you have Comey, where there's a lot of effort going into seeing, hey, one thing we are hearing is happening in the investigation is people are trying to see, did Donald Trump say to other members of his justice staff, his national security staff, that he wanted to fire Comey or otherwise impede the Russia investigation? But he has also just said publicly that that's what he was doing and what he did.
Yeah, so I'm not saying that getting that evidentiary record. Rosenstein knew whether that was the reason. If he knew that was the reason, he told us in the SCIF, in the secure room, that he knew before he wrote the Comey memo on the Hillary investigation that Trump was going to fire Comey. And so why did he write that thing? I don't get that. And then basically, Rosenstein just said that everything else he couldn't say because it might come under the scope of Mueller's investigation. And it didn't track for me that Rosenstein told us that bit of information that he knew beforehand, before he wrote the memo, that Trump was going to fire, because that seems to be under the scope of the investigation too. So I had a real problem with Rosenstein's classified briefing he had with us. I had real problems because he just basically wouldn't answer anything, except he would say that Sessions hadn't violated his recusal. He just kept asserting that, and I don't know how he could make that assertion. I don't know. It just seems to me that Sessions said that he recused himself on the Russia investigation. Trump said he fired Comey because of the Russian investigation. And yet he was in that chain. He was in that chain of letters. There's a lot here that's inconsistent. It's not that it doesn't make sense to me. I mean, it makes sense in one way, which is that they're all a bunch of, lying liars. But that's a way to interpret this.
At the Sessions hearing the other day, yeah, motivated in part by the questions you asked him a couple months back, it was very noticeable, I thought, that he was not willing to simply say, no, President Trump did not come to complain to me about the Comey-Russia investigation, and that had no influence on whether or not he was terminated. He seemed he could have just put the questions of how much he was separated from that issue to rest.
Well,
he seemed very concerned about doing that.
I actually thought he handled that kind of cleverly, more cleverly than Coates did. Because he said, well, I could just as easily say yes, too. I mean, he basically, do you remember that
I
part?
I do.
And it was basically, I can't discuss my conversations.
But that's what was so, when you assert a rule that doesn't exist,
yes,
that's a little suspicious. You can discuss your conversations with
the
president.
Well, you think, for example, that if he was going to assert this rule that may or may not exist, let's just be charitable. You'd think that if it does exist, you'd know it.
Sure.
you'd be able to like produce it.
Yes.
At the actual, what I mean? If it's something that you're going to rely on for several hours, why not have it, right? Why not say, this is it?
Among other things, Donald Trump has not used executive privilege yet. Right, he could make a claim, but he has not made that claim.
And then he, at one point, well into this, he said, I want him to be able to use that claim of executive privilege retroactively, I guess. He didn't use the retroactively because that would have kind of revealed how silly that would have been. But he did actually say that, well, I don't want to preempt his ability to use executive privilege to protect what you're asking me.
I'm going to pull us out of the Russian Sessions hole,
yeah,
because that story, I feel like, in the week between when we do this and when it comes out, who knows what will happen?
Oh, my goodness.
It has such a, it has such it a velocity.
I thought this
to
was
it.
Live. No, nothing. They're going to say, wow, that must have been months ago.
This episode is brought to you by State Farm. You've heard it before. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. But it's more than just a tagline. Because State Farm agents are small business owners themselves who live and work in your community. And if you're in the market for small business insurance, who better to work with than an agent who understands what it takes? State Farm agents can help you create a personalized insurance plan that fits your small business needs and budget. Talk to your local State Farm agent today about small business insurance. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
Last week, Kanye West accused one of the biggest Twitch streamers of being an industry plant. It's an idea that comes up so often on platforms like TikTok and elsewhere.
You see people who have blown up seemingly overnight, and the question is, who's behind them, right? That's what everyone wants to know. Tipping the scales and pulling the lever to make them seemingly the next it thing on the internet.
This week on Power User, is it even possible to create an industry plant on the internet? And if so, how?
So I want to go back to the idea of politician skills. And you had a long career as a not just a comic, but a political comic. You did the initial Indecision series at Comedy Central. So you have a very good sense of what it is people hate about politicians. And then as a politician, you've really tried, and I think this is a theme of the book, to learn how to be a politician. So where are the places that you think the public does not understand what politicians are doing and does not give them enough slack?
I think that they don't understand what we have to navigate in terms of how hard it is to work within the institution, within the Senate, and get things done, and how you just you can't just lay down, this is where I am, and I ain't compromising on it. And you get nowhere on that. And it's just, it is a process. And I try to communicate that in the book. I mean, I wrote a chapter on the reform of No Child Left Behind. And it's, you know, it's not like there's bells and whistles, we got a great victory. But it is a example of where we actually, over years and years, like 7 years of admiring the problem, actually figured out that we agreed on about 80% of it and got it done. And I actually heard from somebody who I respect a lot, I won't drag his name through this, that he said his wife was very involved in that process and that I captured it exactly right. And to me, that's an example of, we got more early childhood education, which I believe in, not enough at all. We got more after school, the 21st Century Learning Centers, not nearly enough funding for it. We got these changes in the way the flexibility that states have for testing, that's actually a really good thing. Because otherwise, they just had to do so much testing because they had to have their own state, their own test, the No Child Left Behind test, the national test. There were things that we did that were really good that took an enormous amount of just hashing out and hashing out and hashing out. But we did something. We accomplished something. And I think that a lot of people, I write about politophobes. And there are people who think that there, you know, there obviously exists an objectively good policy regarding education. And they all know what it is, but they all got vested interests. They all, and that's not the case. There's actually real public policy debates where people disagree. And everyone isn't Betsy DeVos, who doesn't know anything. You know, everybody on that, she doesn't represent everybody who care. I'm against choice. I'm against choice for the probably a lot of the same reasons that she's for it. She wants to get money to, she wants kids to go to religious school. But there are really legitimate policy disagreements and arguments that have to be argued out. Now, that said, what they're doing now on healthcare is a crime.
I want to put a pin in healthcare. We're gonna do some healthcare.
Yeah,
but I do want to stay on the point of compromise here for a second, because this seems to me to be a place where, particularly right now in politics, there are very conflicted intuitions. That on the one hand, people would like to see a politics, or feel like they would like to see a politics where the two sides get along better, where they come together for the good of the country. Then there is a simultaneous political impulse that argues that compromise is sullying, that when you've given something up, you've given too much up, that there is something about it that's sort of going Washington and selling out your principles.
And I write about that too. I mean, I think...
Well, your book is a magisterial overview, so it's you got all this stuff in there.
Well, no, I think I have cracks in my soul.
Oh, cracks in your soul, right.
Yeah, yes. I mean, there's a...
Can you tell that story? That's a very funny story in the book.
Well, there's a woman comes up to me, and I've been, I don't know, in the Senate for maybe 2-3 years at the time, and I'm at a reception for this awards for theater in the Twin Cities. And we have more, I think, stage space per person population than any city in the country except for New York. So I'm at this reception, and this woman comes up to me and she says, "You've been in Washington for 2 years now, and I can see cracks in your soul." And that's not something you want to hear about your soul. And, you know, you've seen corruption and you've seen there are cracks in your soul, and I want you to be whole and green. And I said, "I'm getting a massage tomorrow." And she thought that was good. I didn't say what Barney Frank said, which is something effective. I've only voted for one person who believes 100% of what I believe. I've only done that once in my life. That's when I voted for myself the first time.
I like that the first time clause.
Yeah. And it does change you when you hear, but, and I try to explain that, and I try to be honest with people. It is a bit of a mind, you know, it plays with you a little bit, with your mind and your soul being in here and wondering, are you compromising enough or too much or the right way? Or is this the one I, you know, fight on? This is the one I just, should I vote on this? As if my vote were the deciding vote. I used to say that. I'm going to vote as if I were the deciding vote. I'm going to vote that way. And now I just, what was that about?
So what is like, what is your rubric
what
now?
What was that about? I don't know if I can. I can't articulate it quite as plainly as that. I mean, I almost always vote. I have a pretty clear idea of why I'm going to vote for something. But sometimes you get to an omnibus spending bill where there's 8 things in it that just are horrible in it, and there's 12 things that are terrific in it, and you could vote no because of the 8 things, you could vote yes because of the 12 things, you could vote no because one of the 8 things is so horrible, and then you know, even if 6 of the 12 things are stuff you wrote, you're still going to vote no. I mean, it's very, you have to make these decisions.
When you look at the senators who are the most effective in your point of view, what are the skills they've developed? What makes a senator effective?
I think they're people that have credibility with colleagues, both in terms of policy. Credibility, that means, and that's partly just having that knowledge yourself, but also having staff that are really good. And it's also that success builds success. If you've worked with people before and been able to get something done with them, that builds partnerships. And, you know, to some degree, some seniority helps. Being a committee chairman really helps, or being a ranking member. But this is why I wrote the Ted Cruz chapter, is that he's not gotten anything done, because his word's not good. And I write a story about that that kind of demonstrates that. And he's like an exception. Everyone else, I think, tries to be effective. And that's the satisfaction that comes with the job for me, is when I get something done.
Your Ted Cruz chapter is, it's very funny, but it's also, I thought, an interesting answer to a question that was very prevalent during the primary, which is Republican establishment did not like Donald Trump, was afraid of Donald Trump.
Sure.
At a certain point, it's clear Ted Cruz was the best chance to stop him.
Mm-hmm.
And they could not get anywhere near uniting behind Ted Cruz. And you provide something of an answer to this. What's that answer?
The answer is he's just a toxic person. And you can't trust him. He's very smart. But there's a lot of people in the Senate who are very smart. And they're not sociopaths.
And I think people would look at that from the outside and wonder, okay, are you saying that ideologically he's a sociopath? You're saying he's very conservative? But no, that's not what you're saying.
No, I'm saying that he does not, there's something about him that's untrustworthy. As I say in the chapter, something you should know about Ted Cruz is that I probably like Ted Cruz more than most of my colleagues like Ted Cruz, and I hate Ted Cruz. And the reason I like him more than my other colleagues is that he actually has a sense of humor. He does. And he's very smart. And he doesn't have a great sense of humor, but he's smart enough to compensate for that. And he has a decent sense of humor. And he values humor, sort of. But everything else about him is just, and I tell, this is read the book kind of thing. I mean, I don't want to tell, because they're long stories. And part of the reason they're good long stories is that they're sort of shaggy dog stories that end with a shocking ending. And the shocking ending is like, oh my God.
It's usually that he's
really
lying. The ending.
It's a version of lying.
And that's what I thought was interesting. That's what I was trying to zone in on here, because I think people look at politics and they say there's a lot of lying.
Yeah.
I think they look at even the Senate and they say if you check a lot of these statistics, they are not true. But what you sort of identify in him, which I thought was interesting, is a shamelessness around the lying, a sort of willingness to just say, nope, I never said that, or to not correct. It seemed that it was something, it's almost a secondary. Like, once he's called out, that seems to be where your offense comes
in. That's the specific of that story. But it's just one example of the very many different ways he constantly sort of offends people. You know, I had somebody who is a person around Washington who was trying to organize the chiefs of staff, Republican and Democratic chiefs of staff, to kind of talk with each other more and to get in order to get some stuff done and build trust. And one of the Republican chiefs of staff said, do not include Cruz's chief of staff, because you can't trust this guy at all. And their whole reason for being is to talk to his own base about, I'm not here to make 99 new friends. that Washington is inherently corrupt, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And the more he can just say that, but he hasn't gotten anything done except close the government down, shut the government down.
You talk a lot in the book about the dehumorizer and the ways in which the jokes you told throughout your career were thrown back at you, ripped of context.
Yes.
When you ran for office. And it struck me as interesting because it feels to me that broader decontextualization, both of jokes and of not jokes now, I mean, you just see something somebody was saying as part of an argument, a little piece of it gets pulled out on Twitter and it ricochets around the world.
Right.
And it seemed to me that what you were arguing in the book was that the skill you had to learn was that you just weren't going to be able to persuade everyone.
Right. You can't litigate comedy. And you also have to be careful to hand people something that can be taken wildly out of context. And you start to internalize those rules. And that's why people go like, people in Washington don't seem authentic. They all sound like they're talking from talking points. And there are, you have to trust yourself to not be handing them something that they can hit you over the head with by decontextualizing it.
But I'm curious about the personal side of it. And maybe I'm curious because it's something that I deal with just as a writer, where pieces of mine will get interpreted wrongly or framed in a way I don't think is accurate.
Not fun, is it?
No, it's not fun at all.
You didn't like it, did you?
It's why I try to visit it upon politicians as often as I can.
Yes.
And it seemed to me that...
Got a little taste of your own medicine, didn't you?
What is the experience like, not just of recognize you can't litigate comedy, but just there are going to be people out there who are just, you're just not going to persuade them that you were trying your best, that you were being a good person.
I mean, oh, well, that's of course.
Was that strange for you going into politics?
Oh, no. I mean, I wrote enough about that. It was, I had a unique situation, which is I had 35, 40 years of comedy that was satirical. I mean, one of the things I point to is I wrote an article in Playboy, and there was a paragraph in it about, it was for the millennial issue, so it was about new technologies and how their Playboy readers are going to benefit from them, and everybody. And so I say, the internet is a great learning tool. My son did a great sixth grade report last year on bestiality using the internet. He downloaded a lot of great visual aids, and the kids in the class just loved them because, you know, at that age, they're just sponges. Okay, now, that's actually a conservative joke. That's saying, hey, parents, check what your kids are looking at on the internet, right? And that they turn that into an ad where Al Franken tells jokes about bestiality, and you know, from infinity through your eyeballs, bestiality comes out. And my mother-in-law cried when she saw that ad. And not, she didn't cry because she thought I did jokes about bestiality or that I, you know, was doing something awful. She cried because what they're doing to my son-in-law, you know? And it just... And at a certain point, you can't go, okay, the context of that bestiality joke was this. It wasn't, you know, you can't do that. You just can't do it.
But it's interesting. One of the things that I thought was fascinating is a matter of political strategy.
But I do it in the book. I do that in the book.
Yes, you do litigate a lot of the comedy in the book.
Well, I litigate some, and I talk about disastrously trying to litigate one.
There was a fascinating... You have a great section on the your initial election to the Senate and the campaign. And what struck me about the strategy of that was when your opponent, Norm Coleman, would do something at you, the response wasn't sort of a counterpunch. It was a different punch. The strategy is you sort of are always on trying to do your own kind of offense. It's not a sort of conversation where you butt somebody's point. It's the act of running for office is just figuring out how to make your message the dominant one and not get sort of taken off track trying to respond to their messages. Is that one of the lessons?
Yeah, because his only message was, you know, Al Franken is awful. And he has this history of saying terrible things, and he's going to do that as a senator. And you don't respond to that because then that's, you know, it's that old thing with LBJ that some... It said, we can't accuse your opponent of having sex with a donkey. And he just says, I just want to hear him deny it. So, you know, you can't, you just don't respond to that stuff.
Eurovision is here. This year's contest gets underway this week in Malmö, Sweden. But this year's contest comes with a dose of controversy. I'll give you one guess as to what people are mad about. Yes, correct. It's that.
Organizers of the Eurovision Song Contest say they are assessing whether Israel's entry breaks the rules on political neutrality.
I think it's a shame. I think there's no way that Israel should be able to participate in Eurovision.
Pro-Palestinian protesters are taking to the Swedish streets. More than 1,000 Swedish artists, including Robin, have called for an Israel ban. Some European politicians are joining them. Charlie Harding from Switched On Pop joins us this week on Today Explained to help us figure out if Europe can sing its way out of this situation.
You've got a great line in the book that I've been thinking about since I read it, which is that being a senator does mean finding a way to make friends with people you're fighting against with every fiber of your being. but it also means finding a way to fight with every fiber of your being against people you're friends with. How do you draw those lines? Where can you go such that the fight does not make those relationships impossible down the road?
I think we all understand it, or most of us do. I think you get it. And this isn't to say that, you know, I also write in the book that this isn't going to be your typical book that's written by U.S. senators, for instance. I'm not going to write stuff like Mitch McConnell and I may disagree, but when we're off the clock, we're the best of friends. Sometimes we go to dinner and Mitch will laugh so hard that milk shoots out of his nose. No, I'm not going to be writing cliches like that. And, you know, my best friends tend to be Democrats and tend to be people. We do spend more time with each other. They have caucus lunches 3 times a week. So they spend a lot of time with each other.
How often do the Democrats have them?
Twice.
And it's that third one that really seems crazy to you?
Well, you're only here. I mean, people aren't here for lunch on Monday or Friday. So it means like essentially they have one every day. At least we have a day we don't do it. It's on Wednesday. But they're just meeting every day for lunch, plotting, I guess, or strategizing, let's say. And so, yeah, the people you're closest to tend to be people in your own party, but you also have to make friendships with people who aren't.
The place I wanted to go with that is how do you forgive or how do you compartmentalize? So right now we're watching, I guess it may not end up being called the American Healthcare Act, but the Senate Republicans are crafting in secret a healthcare bill.
Yeah, it's terrible.
They attacked you guys for a very long time about a secretive process, about not enough public deliberation, about not being open about it, about not being transparent.
It's almost as if they're being hypocritical.
But it's beyond that, right? I mean, it is something I've actually never quite seen a process like this one. So if they do this, if they sort of do this bill in the dark of night, jam it through, take healthcare from 20 million people, what happens next for you? Is it hard to believe things they say? Is it hard to sort of say, you know, take it at face value? I mean, how do you...
Oh, it's very hard. Yeah. I mean, there's lying one person to another, and that's what I was kind of talking about with Cruz and stuff. And then there is just the whole basic saying stuff on the floor that just isn't true. And that's sort of like, okay, that's pretty standard operating procedure. I think with them, I don't think we do that. But on healthcare, they said that, and this sort of complaining about the process we had, I don't know how many hearings, but must have done...
No, I had to cover them.
Yeah, I mean, we did all these hearings on healthcare, and there are all kinds of Republican amendments in it. Now, they chose not to vote for it, so they'll say, well, you did it just with Democratic votes, and I suppose there's a point there. But the ACA accomplished a lot for people. And what it did, basically, was... 20 million more people got health insurance. People with pre-existing conditions were protected. We have a couple of areas in the ACA that are not working. And part of it is the exchanges, and part of it is that they've sabotaged that. And they did it by getting rid of the risk corridors, that Rubio did that on one of these end-of-the-year packages. And they are sabotaging it now by not doing the cost sharing or by holding that hostage. And then the other part is pharmaceuticals. We had a hearing actually on pharmaceuticals, and that was a bipartisan effort to get that done. But this stinks. And what they're doing is going to hurt a lot of people. Now, I don't know what they're going to come up with. There's no way for me to know what they're doing right now, but the House bill is mean, to quote somebody who is very wise about healthcare. In fact, I think he was the first person to understand that healthcare was complicated.
So when you go through this process, something that I have found difficult in covering it is to figure out how Senate Republicans, and I've been asking them this question, feel like the hero of their own story here. they know what this process looks like. They know what they said. This is a bigger, I know there's a lot of lying in politics. This has felt like something I haven't seen before. It has been like the process and what is,
well, I mean,
it's felt really, I'm not shocked by much. I'm pretty jaded. I've been covering this stuff for 15 years, but I've been taken aback by this.
This isn't complete lying. This is shamelessness. I mean, there's a little bit of difference. I mean, to accuse somebody of like ramming through healthcare, the Affordable Care Act, that was kind of very misleading and stuff. And then to do an exaggerated version of what you accuse the other side of doing is shameless. It's not lying. It's just complete and utter shamelessness.
One of the things that seems to have been true in the Senate in the last, maybe has always been true, but certainly in the last 10 years, has been that anything people say on process is worthless. So both sides have said things about the filibuster when they were trying to defend it that were incredibly honoring of the practice. And then when they were trying to get rid of it, sort of completely flip-flopped. You've seen this healthcare act being moved through in a shameless way, as you put it. It feels to me watching it that the norms and rules of the place are beginning to break down. We're seeing a fair number of rules changes. Democrats change the filibuster rules and Republicans change them again. Do you think that the institution itself is in danger of fracturing, at least in the way its processes are constructed?
Well, I think that, look, I was there when we voted. We used a nuclear option on judges and circuit court judges and district court judges and on executive nominations because they were blocking all these people that we needed for the government to run, and they were blocking the First Circuit or the D.C. Circuit court judges. But we begged them. We met in the old Senate chamber without microphones, close to everybody, and we said, please do a gang of 14. We're just begging you to do this so we don't have to do the nuclear option. That's what we were saying. They were holding up the guy in Treasury who was supposed to make sure that terrorists didn't get funneled money, right? They were holding that up. I mean, and they would not do that. They wouldn't do it. They would not do what had been done 2005 on the when the nuclear option had been threatened, and there was a gang of 14 that stopped that from happening, seven on each side, who said, okay, our vote, we pledge that we will vote with each other and we can stop this misuse of this from happening. And they wouldn't do it.
Should there be a filibuster at all?
I think there should be. And I think it should be there because you want to get some consensus. I think there are things that are better if they're built with some consensus.
I have wondered about whether the filibuster creates consensus for this reason. And this is particularly during the Obama era, it looked like this to me. But so the theory there is that by having to achieve a 60 vote threshold, which usually neither party has, you've got to win over members of the other side. And so you got to get consensus. But the other piece of that is that the other side realizes they can actually block the thing entirely. And it might be that their first best outcome is to block it entirely. But if they can't block it entirely, then it's better to actually be on the bill and shape it a little bit. And by giving the minority so often the ability to kill things outright, it reduces a minority's incentive to actually play ball at all.
Yeah, but on the other hand, if the side that can pass it with 51 votes has 51 votes, what's their motivation for accepting any compromise?
Well, it seemed to me traditionally members of the Senate want bipartisanship. Presidents want bipartisanship for some of the reasons we talked about earlier, that when these bills look very partisan, when they seem, I think, as Mitch McConnell put it, that there's a great debate happening, people decide, well, you know what? If this was a good bill, you'd have people from both sides supporting it. That felt to me to be the actual insight McConnell leveraged for quite a while, that just the act of making something partisan made the public think it's bad. And the minority controls the ability to make it partisan. I mean, so too does a majority to some degree.
Mm-hmm. Well, okay, Mitch was right. Now, I mean, we saw in Gorsuch, they just did it, and they had the majority. So now we get Supreme Court justices just with majority. And so if the president's party is the majority in the Senate, he can nominate anybody he wants. And you've seen his ability to nominate really, really extreme people. So I think there is a role for the filibuster. I mean, there's the downside to it, and we could go round and round on this.
Do you wish you still had it on nominations, on executive branch nominations? It feels to me that things like Betsy DeVos and possibly even Sessions would not have passed in a filibuster world.
They probably wouldn't have. And I mean, DeVos was the first time in history the vice president had to come down. And I was completely opposed to her. I felt that she didn't have the interests of our children at heart. I felt she had the interests of the kingdom of God in mind.
So inside the Democratic Party right now, in a world where Donald Trump is president, where these things are moving through, what is the ferment like? What, in your experience, sort of talking to Senate Democrats, is a sense of where the Democratic agenda has to go to be responsive to this moment?
I think at this moment, we're focused on one thing, and that's healthcare. You know, I'm co-chairman of the Rural Health Caucus, and I go around Minnesota. And during this period, people in rural Minnesota, many of whom voted for Trump, hate this thing. Hate what passed out of the House. And, you know, I've had roundtables where people are crying because a woman said that, you know, her mom will lose her home health care, which she gets through Medicaid. And she and her husband both work, and they don't know what they're going to do with their mom because neither of them can take care of her. And so this is our big focus right now. Obviously, I'm on judiciary, so I've been involved in this Russia and those hearings in judiciary. You know, climate is an existential issue for us. So there's lots of stuff we're focused on. We lost the damn election, you know, and so we're not in the majority. And on healthcare, we had a bipartisan lunch today. Because Johnny Isaacson, who's a great guy from Georgia, had this great guy, Sam Huff, who is a world-class barbecuer. He does this every year. So we had, actually, we had some real conversations. Dick Durbin and Lamar Alexander and I were talking about healthcare. And we don't have enough of those discussions, and we're having a very broad discussion about it. And I'm very concerned that they will get 50 votes for something and jam it through.
I'm actually curious why those kinds of Gang of 14 style coalitions don't seem to emerge more often and have more power. There's nothing stopping a group of relatively moderate senators of banding together 10 or 12 of them and really exerting a hammerlock on what can move through right now and pushing a lot on the process. But that seems to be rarer than it used to be. And folks seem to be, the level of party discipline seems really profound.
Yeah, it was interesting because there were a number of Democrats who wanted to try to do that on Gorsuch. And they felt that they were going to go to the nuclear option. So could they, you know, to preserve the 60 vote threshold on Supreme Court nominees, would there be enough Republicans? It'd have to be quite a few. would there be enough to form a gang? And we would say Gorsuch gets to go through, but on the next one, you know, it has to be 60. You will not vote to get rid of the filibuster. And part of the reason it would have had to have been a lot of Republicans is that we have 25 up next time. So that this might come, that the number that you need to preserve the filibuster might be more than the three you need now. So we couldn't get it. They couldn't get it. I wasn't one of the people trying to do it, but I mean, they just couldn't get it done.
So I grew up in, this is a bit of a time change, but I grew up in California, and the first politician, national politician I ever met was Paul Wellstone, and had a sort of an amazing experience meeting him. And I think it's a significant part of the reason I eventually went into politics. What did you learn from Paul Wellstone, who, for those who don't know, who is a quite remarkable senator from Minnesota, whose seat you now hold?
Well, he's the reason I did this. Paul just had a passion about him. He was someone who believed in organizing. He was somebody who believed in grassroots politics. I met him through my parents. My dad in 1990, Paul's first run for the Senate. My dad was in a senior citizen theater troupe that went to nursing homes. So that's pretty grassroots. And Paul had this remarkable passion and energy and just commitment to people who were middle class and people who were aspiring to be in the middle class and people who were disabled and people who had mental illness. And he said that politics belongs to those who work hard and, you know, and who care. And I think he's right. I think that's the way we win. And he also said that you can't ignore the prosaic parts of politics, the door knocking and every piece of it. Because if you do that, you'll be consigned to losing.
I think that's probably a good place to end it. I'll ask you the question we used to close the podcast, which are, what are three books you've read that have influenced you that you'd recommend to the audience?
Wow. Okay. Recently, I just read the Sheldon's book, Captured. And Sheldon Whitehouse, yeah. I'm sorry. Sounds very much like a senator. Sheldon's book. Sheldon Whitehouse is a Democratic senator from Rhode Island, and he's written a book called Captured, which is just about how large corporate America has captured the courts, have captured campaign finance, have captured regulatory agencies. It's a very efficiently, very Sheldon-y book, and I'd recommend it. There's a book called How Children Succeed by Paul Tough, which is about how adverse childhood experiences change the brain chemistry of kids and how it makes it very difficult to learn. And adverse childhood experiences are things like extreme poverty, which can be hunger, witnessing violence, being abused yourself, being sexually abused. One form of abuse is neglect, being exposed to violence in where you live. The more adverse childhood experiences you have, the less likely you are to graduate. But those things can be, that trauma can be treated, and kids who actually survive that and make it have a lot of resilience. It's a really interesting book in terms of when you're trying to decide whether schools are succeeding or not, that you have to take in more into account than just, you know, how good are the teachers. And there's a book that's kind of a companion with that, which is by Robert Putnam, who wrote Bowling Alone. This is called Our Kids. He starts with a chapter about how his town, I think it was Port Huron, Ohio, what it was like in 1959 when he graduated from high school. And there was one high school, and the richest kid in town knew the poorest kids in town. The poorest kids in town were to Black kids who have now have postgraduate degrees and have gone on to the great success. And now in Port Huron, there are two high schools, and one's the upper middle class high school, and the other is the working class and poor high school. And he kind of compares the kids and neighborhoods and opportunities of one to the other. And it's a very, 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 very different picture from what it was when he graduated. And then he does the same thing in Atlanta and in I can't remember in California where they were, I think somewhere in the South San Francisco or something. And you see that this is repeated over and over and over again. And you see that these children in these lower middle class, working class schools are exposed to these adverse childhood experiences far more, and they don't have the opportunities these other kids have. And so those two books read together, I think, are very eye-opening.
Senator Al Franken, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you to Senator Franken for being here, for taking the time, to all of you for listening, and also for taking the time. You are the reason we do this podcast. I'm always grateful. Thank you to my producer, Bert Pinkerton, to Carly Citrin for engineering help. Ezra Klein will be back next week.